Hello, friends. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by TradingView.com. TradingView.com allows you to chart stocks, ETFs, futures, cryptocurrencies. You can do all of this on your laptop, your desktop, but also your phone. I use it every day to keep track of my portfolio and look for new trading ideas out there. You can support the podcast by going to creatingfuturewealth.com/tradingview, and there you can sign up for a free trial of the pro membership that gives you up to 8 charts per screen, up to 5 indicators. It's a really great software package. It's available on the web, on Android, on iPhone. Go and check it out. creatingfuturewealth.com/tradingview.
1, 2, 3,
listen.
Today, I have Mike Rubini. Rubini does a lot of data scraping work online, and I really wanted to have him on the broadcast today to talk about not only his data scraping work, but what kind of challenges he's come across building various startups. He's the owner of various SaaS projects online. I'll let him go a little bit deeper into exactly what he's working on. But Mike, welcome to the broadcast. How are you doing today?
Hey, Jeff, thank you for having me. I'm very, very well here in southern Italy. And yeah, again, thank you for having me. And I'm looking forward to talk with you.
Thank you. Yeah, the pleasure is all mine. Why don't you tell the audience here exactly what kind of stuff do you work on?
Yeah, so basically I do software. So I create SaaS, which is a short for software as a service. And I have multiple SaaS right now, multiple software that I run that basically all of them are somewhat related to data scraping. So,
excellent. And then, so data scraping, for those that don't really know what that's all about, is basically websites that are out there, whether that be different businesses or Spotify or any kind of thing. You can be able to scrape some of that data and make it useful. So that provides some insights into businesses. How valuable would you say data is to people in this internet marketplace that we have? So basically, like everyone having their business online, how valuable is this data?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's very valuable because it's like, I mean, you've got a driving license, right? So why would you drive blindfolded? You wouldn't, right? So that's why you need data in the internet businesses, because you need to make like decisions that are based on data. And a lot of business owners in any industry are basically driving blindfolded, and at least, you know, from my perspective. And that's why we need more tools that facilitate the use and the the gathering of this data, and as well the fruition of this data, because you know we have a lot of problems with data. one for sure is that we have a lot of it. Like, information nowadays is widely available, and the quantity of data that is being generated in the marketplace right now is, you know, outstanding. It's very big. And, you know, every second we have new data generated. And this causes a problem, of course, which is known as information overload. So we have a lot of information. We can choose which information is good, which information is relevant. And then another problem that we have is that information is all over the place, basically. And this problem is called information fragmentation. Basically, we have information distributed across different channels, devices, and so that's why information and data today is a very complex job to handle. And I guess another thing is that we need, you know, as much as we grow, we also need data that we can handle in real time, so as real time as possible. And so speed of acquisition is also another problem. And so these are, to me, the three, four biggest problems that are related to data and that I'm trying personally you know, in a small setting to solve for some people in certain industries.
It's really amazing with the amount of data that's out there. How do you even get started with just the sheer mass amount of not only data, but from various sources and various types of data? How do you even get started on one of your projects to gather this? How do you put a plan together to process all that?
Yeah, it depends on you know, what you want to source, obviously. For example, I mean, I can speak to Engage, which is one of my SaaS. It's called Engage. You can find it at engage.net, and it's Engage with the initial A instead of an E. And that's basically because that was the first cool domain name available. I don't spend too much time, you know, on these things, domains and layouts, especially in the first iterations of the product, because you know, one of my things is velocity. I want to go to market as soon as possible. But yeah, to your question, like for example, in Engage we have a lot of data sources that we use, and we have data on. So Engage is an e-commerce product. So our customers are basically dropshippers and store owners in general. And basically what we do is we help them decide on which products to sell. And we have, as I said, different data sources. We have data on stores. We have data on products, on suppliers, news, ads, you know, sales, buyers. So all of these data points we are able to not only get, but also structure in a way that provide kind of an intelligence, another brain to them, to then choose what products to sell. And that's done basically via also some kind of AI, which is now it's like a buzzword, but because it's the new trend right now. But obviously AI is big and it's going to be very relevant for data, because you want to sort this data and also understand which data is relevant for you know, a certain type of customers. And with this, we basically dive in personalization, which is also a cool word right now. But yeah, these are all things that are practical for me. I don't do it just because you know, they are cool words. It's practical and needs to be done this way to have an efficient product.
And is that how you came across your ideas for these projects? Was it something that you were interested in yourself and needed to use? Or did you have a friend that said, hey, you know, I need help deciding what products to sell online, and then you came up with it?
Yeah, it depends. It depends. Some problems, I do these solutions because I had this problem myself. But some other times I don't do it because of that. I do just because I'm curious enough to dig, you know. I mean, that's, I would say, one of my characteristics is that I like to, you know, break things, as you would say. And I think that's essential to do this job. It's like you have to have that kind of attitude when you do this. Because, I mean, obviously, you have public data and somewhat public data that you can scrape. And so you have to find loopholes, and, I mean, not illegal, but legal loopholes that you can find and get our data of our competitor, for example. So you have to be on alert and be curious about things. I mean, and I don't know if you want, we can dive into my background a little bit, but basically, I'm a musician, but I'm also very attracted by machines and programming. But when I was a child, I wasn't into programming on a local machine. Like, I didn't want to program the next, you know, calculator type of things that you do when you learn to program.
Yeah,
I was very much into sockets right away, so very much into remote stuff. I like to work with the internet right away. And so when I was younger, I was in security too. Not officially, obviously, but like I was breaking things there too. And yeah, when I was younger, I did all the type of stuff that cool kids do. Like, you know, I was on edge all day and, you know, trying to figure out vulnerabilities to websites in the early days, which was really fun and really easy too. And I remember, like, you could scrape Google, and Google didn't have a captcha.
Yeah, back then it was a lot more fun to be hacking around and doing all kinds of fun stuff. I remember myself doing it, like trying to break websites and FTP sites and gain access to directories and stuff. And it's almost like now there's so many more roadblocks that, of course, it's still fun and challenging, but like compared to back then, it's like walking in a park.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, that's basically when I started. I mean, like for most part of my life, I basically studied music because I was, well, since I was 4 years old, I basically played music. I'm a saxophone player, and in particularly I like jazz. And yeah, when I was 18, I graduated from the local conservatory in saxophone. And I won a scholarship to go to New York and basically study jazz there at a top university in New York. And there, basically, I was struck by, you know, the reality of jazz, which is you can really earn a living by doing jazz if you are not, you know, the top of the top. And even then, like, it's not like a life of you know, amazing perks, and you know, it's a good life, but not the kind of life that I wanted to have. And I've seen like really amazing musicians play for like a pizza, really amazing musician, and so I was like, I have to do something here. And and actually I started learning some marketing. And from there, I did my first service, which was called fieldwork in the in those times. And then it switched to jazz services, which you can find today still at jazz.services. And that's basically a service where we helped jazz musicians and jazz brands with social media. So I started doing social media marketing services, like first myself, and then I outsourced them. And yeah, that way I basically, you know, paid some months in college. And yeah, we became basically the leaders in those fields because it was a niche, and that niche was the jazz niche. So it was very, very small, and I was a musician, I was a jazz musician, so I understood the problems that the niche was having. Although it was very small niche, so you can't really scale there, but it was a good to start for sure. I mean, from there I actually founded another service called Geeks, which you can find at geeks.co. It's geex.co. And that's basically another niche service, but we help startups. And we helped a lot of startups with marketing, really a lot. And I, you know, in those years, I started, you know, learning about, you know, investors, the startup world, basically. And, you know, it was really fun. And I also switched to not doing the work myself. You know, I've been outsourcing jobs, basically in an arbitrage model where I would get a job and then outsource it to someone else to do it. And it was really fun, and it was profitable too. But still, it was not, you know, completely passive. And, you know, you still had to like handle the clients and stuff. That's why I then switched to software. But it was really fun, and I also learned about outsourcing, which is one of my top abilities, I would say, even now, because you need to outsource in a certain way so that you know your outsourcer can know what to do. And my principle there is like, you know, there are some people that use experts and then they outsource to experts. My strategy is a little different. I hire people that basically don't know anything. You know, as long as they have a computer, they speak somewhat English, for me it's good, and I hire them. And then I teach them step by step what they need to do. I have a process for that, but it's very good for me. It has been proven to be good, and that way I also save a lot of money and I can bootstrap, which is what I do now.
Yeah, that's really great. The outsourcing aspect, I think, is something that a lot of people kind of miss in their business. Is we talked about this in a previous episode of the podcast with Robin yep. Waite, and he talks a lot about basically stop selling your time because you only have so much time, and you really yep. have to create systems in place that other people can manage for you. So would you say that has really helped you be able to handle so many projects, because you have quite a lot of SaaS projects out there?
Yeah, for sure. It's also a great way to kind of share expenses between the projects. For example, I do everything myself nowadays on SaaS, but the one thing that I don't do is sales and support to the current customers, basically. So I have three Filipino families that kind of help me there, and they are on a shift of 8 hours. They do shifts, and they cover 24 hours, Monday to Friday, which is really amazing. For me to have a real person that kind of support the customer. And, you know, I don't spend much there. Like, I pay them $3 per hour, something like that. So it's great. Like, and but they didn't know anything. I basically taught them what to do and what to say and how the whole things works. Usually what I do is I put up some documents. I kind of differentiate between documents between systems, resources, type of documents. So on a system, it's basically procedures that they have to refer to know how to do something. It's like step by step. And resources are like meeting agenda, templates, you know, all this stuff that they can refer, but it's not step by step. It's more like documents that they need to work on. And yeah, for systems, basically I make sure that I have, you know, the name of the procedure, what department it refers to, what KPIs they need to work on. For example, for this type of job, which is the chat sale agent, as I call it, the KPI would be number of conversations per day that they have with customers. And then I always include like a minimum result, which is they should be able to make at least one sale or upgrade per day. And then who managed that document, in this case would be me. And how often do you update it? Because obviously things change and you need to update the SOP, the procedure. And then I always include who has to do what and when, of course. And then I do some table of contents, that really differ on what the job is. But I make sure to treat them as a computer. So really, the smaller the step, the better. So like step one would be I don't know, open the browser. Step two would be type in engage.net. Step three would be, I don't know, open the chat. It's like ridiculously small, and even a dumb person would do it.
Yeah, and would you say that actually because they're not experts, that they probably perform a lot better because they're not trying to put in their own swagger or kind of, you know, opinion into what you're trying to do? They're just following exactly your system, and that probably gives you a bit more productivity, no?
Yeah, exactly. I prefer to control my procedures instead of giving to someone else. I don't know how it works. It may be that, you know, they have some prior experience, some prior ways to do things that I don't like. So for me, it's like it's better to take brand new people that I can shape as I like.
And then how did you come up with the idea to use Filipino families? Did you go through other sources? Because there are, you know, I've experienced some problems outsourcing to like Bangladesh and a couple other places. And I think for some businesses, it can be like everyone knows you need to outsource a little bit, especially on the support side, to free up your actual ability to build your business. How did you figure out what the best way to outsource was and find the actual people to do that work?
Right. So, I mean, Filipino families, usually it's culture related. Like their culture is not to mess up with a stranger. It's like they are very friendly. They are very respectful. Instead, and of course, I don't want to do, I don't want to be racist or something like that. But that's, you know, from my experience, like working with Filipinos has been great. Other people, maybe from India or Bangladesh, as you said. You can find someone who's friendly as well, etc. But culturally, they are a bit different, and so like I always go for Filipino first. That's my choice. Also, like the currency is stronger here in Italy, and you know there is they can have a good time with the money that they make, and you are spending also a very low amount of money, so it's a win-win for everybody. And they are very also they have faith in you, and they will follow whenever you go. So it's great.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it takes a lot of load off of you, especially on the support end, and you can just focus on your business. So it's a great plan for everyone out there that's listening. Make sure when you get to a certain level, you know, if you find yourself spending too much time on the support end and not really building your project and advancing your business, then definitely check out outsourcing part of what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is you have to automate stuff. And I'm also big on automation, like via software, but sometimes you need people. And I won't be able to automate chat via software. So, but you have to be big on automation because, at a basic level, our systems work is like you have some input and then you have some system that does the work and process this input. And then you have some output and then you see the output and you evaluate it and you go to the feedback loop when you then produce some feedback and you go back to the input phase. And so that's like in a nutshell how the system, any system works. And that's basically what I try to figure out every day. It's like, what can I systematize today? Because, I can do a number of stuff, but if I can produce like a system per day, it means I will systematically add more hours to my day. And because systems, especially not people-based systems, it will run, when you are sleeping, it will run effortlessly 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it's something really liberating about, you know, to think about. And, you know, some people, when they are outsourcing or producing systems, especially to people, worry that, like, these people will, you know, take their job and, you know, leave and take the experience and leave. And, you know, my advice to them would be, you know, work with compartments, so that really a person doesn't know everything. Like, it knows, he or she knows the, like, our job, but it doesn't know how to do all the other jobs, if it makes sense. So that's something you can do if, you know, to mitigate risks. Yeah, for me, it has been working well.
That's a great idea, especially the mitigating risk with keeping everything compartmentalized. You hear a lot about big companies like Apple and Google doing this to protect all of their technology and everything. So even at a smaller level, that is an excellent idea. Did you start automating your processes right away? Or was there a turning point in your business where you said to yourself, hey, you know, I'm way too busy. I need to find someone to handle this chat thing.
No, I actually, with chat, I actually started very, very early because I knew I couldn't do it. Like, it's important to talk with customers for sure. And I can do that whenever I want. I just say, jump in the chat, I do it. But for me, I knew it was important to have a good service so that, like, the customers know that they can talk to a real human, like, 5 days per week. And you know, I knew it, I had to get help there. And it was, like, also, as I said, it's not expensive, but it's money that goes out. And in the first phases, it's not easy to do that decision, to make that decision. But for me, to, you know, I know it was important. And I mean, really, like, getting a team, I'm not for getting the team out of hand, but getting this type of work done by freelancers that you trust is, to me, is key. Also because they now encourage me to do stuff. It's great.
It's nice. The team feeling is a good feeling. I mean, especially when it's your team, you're the leader, and it really gives you a lot of pride in your product, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, my first startup, one of the problem is velocity, which is one of the key to, you know, I have some principles in my company, and velocity is one of it. And basically, one of the reasons that I decided to bootstrap myself and do everything myself is this, is because of velocity. And one of my first startups, it was called BuddyAd. And this is the only startup that I did with investors. And I know you want about failure. Let's talk about my first startup. And BuddyAd basically was what technical people would call a spy tool. And it was for the affiliate marketing industry. So we were basically collecting, you know, millions of ads per day, and seeing the patterns, seeing which ads were sticking, and then we were offering access to marketers who were, you know, promoting ads. Because the principle was, like, the reasoning behind it was that if we see an ad for, you know, 30 days, it means it's working. So someone else can copy it and you know, be profitable with it. Because you know, if an ad is up for 30 days, it means someone is paying for the ads to be up 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. So it means they are profitable. And that was the reason behind it. And it was my first startup, and the first that I did with investors, which were private investors. and they were also affiliate marketers themselves. So they see they saw the value of basically the software, and then we kind of built it together. I mean, one of the things that I saw as a not positive thing was velocity, because we kind of we had more money that I probably will ever have in one of my startups now, and so we hired some people to do programming with me. We were about a team of 3-4 people, depending on the time, but all programmers. And I saw that communication is a cost, basically. I saw that, like, for me to say, you know, to these people, you need to do something, it was better if I did it myself in the first place, because it was much faster, and we could go to market faster and all these things. So I mean, yeah, velocity right now is a great thing, and I try also to set communication guidelines, even with freelancers, that are you know, really strict, so that we can grow fast.
Would you say that that makes it not only competitive, but, you know, helps you survive in this business world, because there's so much competition out there that you yep. mentioned while you're sleeping, you have automations going, and there's always someone working on, you know, usually a competing product. There's with so many people out there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things is that, like if I compete with a behemoth or even like a startup that has investors, and so they have a team size of 15, you know, I'm always gonna have the upper hand, because the thing is, like, I can push a feature in like 15 minutes. For a behemoth, like for a really big company, it would take like probably 30 days to do a single feature in their product, because obviously you have to like to go through the management, you have to go to the developers, explain. So I mean, yeah, you can ship features very easily and very fast, and also you can roll back very easily. So if I don't like how a feature is, I can roll back like in a matter of seconds that feature. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how everything starts as a startup, and then as it gets bigger, it slows down. You know, you have so many layers of code reviews, then lawyer reviews and management reviews,
yeah,
and then reiterations and testing and going back and forth. But at the same time, you are doing a lot of this yourself. How do you find a balance to where you don't burn out?
Yeah, I think like you have to stay healthy. I mean, the first thing is take care of yourself, because you are basically the company. And you know, as founders, as solo founders and solopreneur, we always think like, hey, this competitor has more money, so you know, they for sure got more people, so I have to work extra hard and, you know, work 24/7 to do the same, like to even keep up with them. And if you think that, you also have to think that your competitor is healthier than you, and that you have to be sharp to do the you know, to do the same kind of features, same kind of level of decisions. So basically, you know, the first thing you need to take care of is yourself, and make sure you know you have good rest, you kind of stay in shape. I'm not in shape, but I try to. And come on, I'm Italian, so I have good food here. I mean, also it's also about mitigating risks, because so many times I was like awake at, I don't know, 1 a.m. trying to push code, only to realize, you know, I went to sleep, and then only to realize at 2 a.m. in my dreams that I pushed the wrong code. So I had to go back, you know, because you make mistakes when you are not well rested. So you need to do that. You need to take care of yourself for sure. And also the other thing is that if you are operating all the time, you are in the trenches all the time. Like you are doing the daily work and you are not seeing the big picture. So that's another reason you have to kind of, go for a run or, take a shower and kind of have ideas flow. And that's why I strong advice to, to focus to work, eat healthy, move, sleep well, and get inspiration from nature and experiences, life experiences, real life experiences, not like being in the computer all the time.
Yeah, a lot of the best ideas come from traveling or just walking through the woods or something like that. It's Absolutely. It's so important to take a break from your desk, and especially if you're not figuring out a solution to a problem or the code's just not working. Sometimes as humans, we really want to succeed. So you're sitting there in front of the code and you're just trying and trying. But actually, it's a lot quicker sometimes just to step off for a sec, take a shower, like you said, come back, and you'll probably find the solution a lot quicker.
Yeah, even because for creativity is like really inspired by associating two things that are distant in their subject matter sometimes. So if all you see is like startup world and tech news and things like you will not be able to associate some thoughts, and really come up with sometimes innovative or disruptive, really disruptive ideas. And I think like Ryan Kolb, which is the founder of FOMO, has a great course on creativity. You should have him on the podcast. He's a great guy.
Excellent. What's his name again?
Ryan Kolb.
I'm going to make a note of that. Nice.
Yeah, he's the founder of FOMO. I think he's a great person. He really has like controversial thoughts, which is good because, one of the questions that I like is, what things do you believe to be true that the majority of people think are not true? This is a good question because like if you even for musicians, because like art has to ask questions rather than like do affirmations. And so basically thinking about this question lets you think about all kind of questions and all kind of things that you truly that you truly think are true that other people think are not true. And this is a great question, I think.
Yeah, it's a great way to grow as well, because as society, as humans, and just technology or anything about life in general, we don't want to live inside of a little box. You find people get themselves, they start to struggle with life and they're not feeling very happy. And oftentimes it's because they're not being creative. They're not looking outside of that box and really trying to challenge things.
Yeah, I think we really live in our own bubble sometimes. Also with software, sometimes you say, my market is saturated. But that assumption is not true. It's because you are in the market all the time, so you see, obviously, you see things related to it all the time. But maybe it's not saturated at the end. So you really have to get out of that bubble.
What kind of ways are you keeping track of your ideas? Do you use some kind of project management tool or just lots of notebooks?
No, I use Trello. I have a Trello board, which it was public. I don't know if now it is, but I use Trello for just writing down some software ideas. But yeah, at the end, it's like right now how I do it is with trying to pursue less instead of more. That's how I do it. So one of the things that go ahead. You were saying something.
I'm doing like quality over quantity, basically. So trying to narrow down your ideas to the best one.
No, it's not even that. It's like. So for me, like one thing that I believe is that most people are wrong all the time. That's what I believe. And so one thing that everybody will teach you, it's like is to focus on one thing. And that's because, you know, that way you can focus on one thing, you can grow that thing, and then all of your focus is on that thing only. Instead, what they do, I mean, the thing that everybody tells you is like that it's like a tree, and you water the tree and the tree grows. And like, but if the tree has too much leaves or something, then the tree dies. Like everybody has this analogy that they tell you. What I do is instead, if I adopt a rhizomatic approach, and basically a rhizome in botanics is like a particular plant, and it has multiple entry and exit points. It's like having multiple roots. And by the way, this also was a philosophical concept developed by Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, which is were two French philosophers. And I studied this in music when I was younger first, but then it struck me that that's actually what they do. So one of the principle of this philosophical concept is called multiplicity, which is also something I embrace as a principle of mine in my own business. And basically, multiplicity is a complex structure that does not reference one unity only. It's like you are subtracting from existing ones. So practically what I do, I would take a non-essential feature of a current product and create another product in a different market where that feature becomes essential. That's basically what I do.
Nice, I like that. So you're basically adapting something that's not so useful somewhere and making it useful elsewhere. And that allows you to utilize basically everything you're making. So that's great.
Yeah, basically, it's important to understand that even if one business derives from another business, because the feature is extracted from that, that project, that new business is entirely separated. It's like a new entity. And that's exactly how rhizome work in botanics, same way. But basically, because of this, I'm forcing myself to answer questions like, you know, what can we create with what we already have? And, you know, what we currently have that can be applied to other dissimilar and non-related markets. And these are all obviously all good questions to ask yourself. And as I said, this goes against the common entrepreneurial advice of focusing on one thing or keep the main thing, as some gurus say. And that's exactly what I did with one service of mine, which is called Trendly. And Trendly, it was basically a feature of Engage that I extracted from Engage, and now it's another product. And it can serve other markets like investors. So I took something from an e-commerce product, and I created something else totally unrelated that serves investors. So it's great.
Would you say that this has actually helped your overall business in general? Because one of the topics that we love to focus on with creating future wealth is multiple streams of income. So that multiplicity effect that you're talking about, where you don't have all your eggs in one basket. It works for investing, but I think it also is really important in business. So that way, if one of your services, one of your SaaS projects goes under or starts to lose users, maybe another one is starting to do a lot better.
Yes, exactly. That's another good point to do it. Really, I think that we should make things for the sake of making things. So I don't really try to find another reasons to do things aside from like doing the thing. It's like for music, it's the same thing. I do a lot of parallelism, but for music, it's the same. Like music exists because, you know, it always exists like before us and after us, and probably it always will be. So I don't care if I like it or if I don't like the music. Like I make it because, for music's sake, basically. And so, to your question, for sure, it makes sense to have multiple streams of income. And what people do, they do things kind of horizontally. Like they would do more things to have this multiple stream of income. Right now, I'm experimenting also doing the same thing. So taking the same project, but doing it low ticket or high ticket. Because that's also a way to mitigate risks. For example, in Engage, we do have a dropshipping solution, which we sell monthly for like $20 up to $97 a month, depending on what feature you have in there. But I'm also now trying to do an enterprise solution, which I would like to sell to enterprise or big stores for obviously a lot more money, and it's a more focused version of Engage and has more features for enterprise, and you have pros and cons of sending low tickets at $20 or sending high ticket at $10,000 per month, and I think also, people have to experiment with those models in the same way they do with like just creating multiple streams of income. Because, like for example, with a low ticket, you have a lot of customers, and one of the pro is that if I lose one customer today, I don't lose so much revenue, and obviously. Not all the customers will churn next month, so I can do predictions. It's like a solid business. But on the other hand, you cannot spend so much to acquire a customer, for example. So if I only sell for $20, I can acquire for $20. Whereas for high ticket, I can acquire up to 10,000, hypothetically at least. So, it has all these models have pros and cons, but I think we have to do both.
And what kind of process do you go through to decide your pricing points? So I think that's one of the biggest challenges business owners have. There's so much competition out there, and you think, maybe I charge a little bit less, maybe I charge a little bit more. What was your process behind choosing your pricing?
So it depends on your understanding of the market for sure. But I would say that the way I do it is like I increase price. I think most of the SaaS out there are underpricing, I would like also to increase my pricing, for example on Engage. But the way I do it is like I charge something that would make me profitable in a day, and all my SaaS tend to be profitable in one day because I have virtually no costs. Like I have very very small costs. So I like if I sell one subscription for me, it's profitable, right? And what I was saying, yes. The way that I do it is like I charge $20 and then I see if people buy, and then if they buy, I increase the price to maybe 30, and then if they buy, I increase until they do not buy. So that's the way I do it.
Nice, I like that approach. And with all of these businesses that you're running and so many ideas, what is a big challenge that you faced in your life or just business in general that has maybe had you question everything and you're trying to think of a solution past that? How did you overcome such a problem, and what was the problem in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem, the biggest problem is like the mindset, and really, really have a strong mindset, like having, a strong conviction to even convince yourself of something all the time. Because, you know, obviously, entrepreneurship is a roller coaster. Like there are moments where you're down, moments where you are the king of the world. So yeah, for sure, like the mindset is not a problem, but is difficult to always stay at the same level. And I mean, culturally, I mean, the environment play an important part of that, I think. So for example, my parents want me to teach music, for example, and I actually have got the job last year to teach music in public school, which is like a state job. It's like a solid job. They pay you per month, like the state pays you to do this, right? But I don't like it at all, because it's like I studied years to develop my art, basically. And now I have to teach flute to kids in public schools. It's not it's not the thing that I would like to do with music. It's like I want to play. That's what I want to do with music. And so they really push me to go to teaching in school. But last year I took how do you say in English, vacation year, something like that.
Yeah, sabbatical.
Yeah, sabbatical, that's right. And and basically now in September I have to go there and resign from this job, which is like everyone says that I'm crazy, basically. And like not even my parents, even like the people on the street would say I'm crazy. So yeah, I really strive to get my mindset right, because I know that even if things go bad with my software, which I don't think they will, but if they end up, if I lose everything tomorrow, I can still go get a job with my programming skills for sure. So it's really. There's no risk at all, but culturally it's important to to the environment is important. And actually I've been traveling a lot in 2018 because my girlfriend actually was she's studying medicine and she was in Erasmus and she was in Spain, so I took the chance to travel a lot in those 6 months. And I actually was more productive in those 6 months because, well, when I'm at home, I'm proactive because I know my environment. And obviously when you are traveling, it's different because you change the environment every now and then. So you have to adapt. But you are more inspired by the environment, and you don't have to listen to your parents over and over. So you can ship more features. No, but aside from jokes, travel is really, it's really good to just stay inspired. And go ahead.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, for me, traveling is probably the most influential part of my work, whether that be Amsterdam, London, or anywhere in the world that I've been, I always get a very energetic feeling and a rush of ideas. And it comes from everywhere, kind of like you mentioned, where you're connecting things that aren't related. So maybe you see someone walking down the street doing something and, you know, a totally weird idea pops in your head that you wouldn't have thought, or you watch something on a canal in Amsterdam. And it's a really great point you made as well that you chose.
But I think, I think like your brain is up all the time. Like it's because you are in an unknown location and, you know, everything you see, it's new, which is also like why we will be more tired at the end of the day. But that also means that your brain is always on alert. Whereas here, like if I go to sleep, I know everyone in the street. Like,
yeah. So. And it was a really great point that you made as well, having chosen to basically be on your own and build your own projects over a nice, secure teaching job. Is I think the essence of the point you were making is really that we have to choose happiness over something that's comfortable.
Yeah, for sure. It's not even about that. It's like you have to choose what truly gives you joy, if you can. I mean, if you are in a desperate situation and you have five kids and you have to, you know, put the bread on the table, of course, you know, do whatever it takes, even if it doesn't make you happy for as long as you need. But if you can choose, I think everyone should choose really what sparks joy to them. And for me, that's music, and I need to protect that. And I tried teaching, and it was not healthy for me. Like it was really a low point. Not because in itself it's a not good job, but just because I'm not fit to do that. And that's also the same reason I didn't want to do, like, to play at weddings. Like, I want to defend and protect my art. That's, I think, also important for any kind of art. Like, it's not like music or art in general. It's whatever you do that you think it's your true thing. You need to protect that, and that's a way for me to do it.
Is protecting it, you mean, by always creating something new? So the teaching kind of doesn't fulfill anything because it's the same lessons over and over. Whereas what you're doing now, you're able to always create something new every day.
No, like for me, art, you know, if your art is making pizza, you know, protect that and don't commercialize that. Like if your art is, working your dog at 5 p.m., protect that and make that non-negotiable. Like for me, it's the same thing. And it just happened that my art is music, but it can be anything, really anything for me is art. Like art is not... delegated to artists only, for me at least. And that's why I rarely see like my music is this or my music is that, because I don't think that music is mine, but on the contrary, that I am of the music. So it's art. Yeah, everything could be art.
Yeah, it's a really great way to put it. I think kind of the essence of our conversation has really been to just stay passionate about what you're doing and not be afraid to take risks and, you know, pivot and create new ideas. And even if that doesn't fit with one idea, you can branch out like you've done with your SaaS projects and turn it into another project completely. Yeah. As long as you keep going and you're fulfilling what you feel is your kind of, destiny or what you're passionate about, then that's all that really matters.
Yeah, exactly, for sure.
And for everyone listening, what kind of future do you see businesses headed in the future. We've seen an exponential rate of new businesses come into the market thanks to the invention of the internet. And the internet itself is really not that old. And you see how we've gone in just a really short amount of time to having no search engine, you know, like GeoCities, and you have the web links, the rings that used to be around with the thing at the bottom of a website, and then you click to go to the next website before there were search engines. Remember those?
Yeah, for sure.
And now we have AI that is looking at every website and all the data is at our fingertips. Where do you say the internet and business in general is headed?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, obviously, in terms of data, we will gather always more and more data. Just think about all the IoT devices that, you know, we are just scratching the surface there. So yes, for sure, like the problems that I've stated at the start of the interview, for sure, are going to be massive problems and even increase their weight. So I think data is going to play an important role in decisions making, or like. Always more and more, and I think it will shift from being relegated to C-level people to actually being at the disposal of everybody. And my vision with my company is to help people inform their business and life decisions using data. And I think we can help people follow, understand, predict trends and challenges. And we can really help operative people, like the people that do the work on a daily basis. Whereas now some tools are, as I said, relegated to C-levels operatives, like for example, one industry that I'm in is competitive intelligence, which basically is intelligence on your competitors. You follow them, you see all the choice that they make, and you try to understand why they make. And I think in the future, we will see more and more these tools available to everybody. And we will see, you know, more scenario planning softwares also to understand, which scenario will be true in the future, which is more plausible to become true. And I think those things will impact strategic thinking more and more for sure. So, yeah, that's what I think in a nutshell.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense with the amount of data coming through and tools available. I think in general, it'll help businesses. Thank you for the work that you're doing. That helps a lot of people out there make their business decisions. And I think in the future, people are just going to work better together through data and AI, and outsourcing is going to kind of take care of the rest.
Yeah, in a matter of fact, I think people can do some of the thing right away, even if they don't have the tools. Like for example, I was just recently at a conference about competitive intelligence, and they said that like companies like Spotify or Ericsson, so like big companies, they take the time to first thing do planned changes. So that's one thing that I think even at a small level we can do. It's like every now and then, every X months, let's radically change something to see how it performs. It's like doing A/B test, to speak in marketing terms, but on the old company. It's like change something, see how it works, and then see if before was better or now it's better. And then the other thing is also that nobody's doing is scenario planning. So it's like putting yourself in the shoes of your competitors and trying to destroy your own company. From and obviously you would know all the loopholes in your companies. So that's one thing that nobody's doing. And also scenario planning is also like what will happen if you know Facebook ads instead of $1 per click that we pay now, we pay $3 per click, and so we go out of business. What will happen? And trying to understand all the strategies that you can put in place if that scenario becomes true, so that if that becomes true, you are prepared.
Yeah, it's a great way for survival, especially the competitor part that you mentioned, where you're really trying to make sure that you have not only an edge, but in a way, a strategy to systematically put yourself ahead of everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's been a wonderful talk with you and some thank really you, great insight, really inspirational, I would say, especially with all the work that you're doing. I can't imagine how you keep up with everything. So definitely props to you on that. Is there any final words you would like to say to the audience out there?
No, I mean, I'm now kind of structuring a course on, you know, for developers on how to do the same things that I do. And you have to be a developer to do that. But if you have some coding skills and you want to maybe learn how you can possibly do software yourself without any outside help and market your software and understand, you know, validate the idea and all of those stuff, you can write me. I don't know when or if the course will be live, but yeah, just reach out to me. You can reach out at mike@rubini, which is my last name, .solutions. Reach out to me, and I always love any way to talk with other people who share the same mindset. So
excellent, I love it. And so there you go, everyone, that's Mike, and definitely go out there and check out his projects, get in touch with him. He's a really cool guy, really inspirational, and I think just someone that we can kind of look up to in a business mind, since you're really out there killing it. So thank you very much for your time today, and
hey, thank you, Jeff.
Have a great afternoon.
Yeah, you too, have a great day.
And there you have it, folks. Thanks for listening. See you next time.